I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is somebody that I'd like to get to know a little better. And the first thing I need to ask him is how to pronounce his name, because I haven't actually heard it pronounced yet. So how do you say your name? How do you pronounce it?
Zurius is how it's pronounced.
Okay, I was wondering about that because the X could be like CH, and I thought maybe it's curious or something like that. So Zurius, welcome to the show. I've heard about your music over the past few years because you do electronic music, primarily instrumental electronic music. You had a YouTube channel, and you were sort of part of this broadly maybe vaporwave, fashwave phenomenon, and I like electronic music. So once I heard about you, I kept putting your channel on the background and just listening to it. So I very much appreciate your music, and I thought I would just like to get to know you as a person. So can you tell me a little bit about where you're from and how you got involved in this kind of music?
All right. Well, I'm from the UK. I've been making music like most of my adult life, making electronic music. Although in my mind, that you know, there's no real difference between electronic music and non-electric music. Music is something that happens when it hits your ears. That's where the music happens. Although you can say that there are differences in how the music's produced. In the end, music is something which happens in our minds. What was the question you asked me again? Oh, and how I got into writing music for the dissident right, essentially. It really started in 2015 when there was this video which went viral called With Open Gates, The Forced Collective Suicide of Europe. Now, back then, it was kind of easier for videos to go viral. There wasn't so much censorship as there is now. And the way they censored that video in the end was they contacted the musician whose music had been used in the video. Do you remember that video, by the way? Do you remember With Open Gates?
Yes, I do. I thought it was excellent.
Yeah, it's fantastic, wasn't it?
Yeah, I actually went to a performance, Million Dollar Extreme, in Brooklyn. I think it was in 2015, maybe. Yeah, I think it was in 2015. And all these Brooklyn hipsters were sitting in this performance space waiting for the event to begin. And they played Europe with Open Gates. And they weren't quite sure what to do, how to react, whether to laugh or to cry or to scream or whatever. And I thought that was pretty brilliant, actually. So yeah, it's a very effective, eye-opening piece of video making.
Yeah, yeah. I would assume that your audience would have seen it. And I think it's still around somewhere in some form. Perhaps it'll be on BitChute somewhere. But essentially, it's a political music video, I would say. The person who made it, I think they went by the name of Gex, but nobody really knows who they are or where they're from. And it was essentially a compilation of footage of migrants, you know, it was of the footage from the migrant crisis combined with various things which politicians and imams have said about, you know, the destiny of Europe. Combined with a very powerful synthwave soundtrack by, I forget the name of the artist, but the effect of it was mesmeric. It was extremely powerful, and this thing went viral. And I believe even some major celebrities shared this thing because it was so good. Including Marine Le Pen, who's not a celebrity, she's a politician, of course, in France. And the way the SJWs censored this video was they contacted the musician whose music was used in the video, and they got him to make a copyright claim. And that shut it down. And then on the same day that they shut it down, the Bataclan terrorist attack happened. So it was, for me, this was almost like that, almost twisted the knife, because the video itself was a warning against exactly that kind of event.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact it got shut down by leftist activists using this sort of like sneaky, like around the sort of corner thing, because nothing in the video was untrue. It was just that it was the way the footage was put together. It was the way the narrative was put together in a way that the mainstream would never do. They got it censored by getting the artist. And I thought, well, that is it, the whole thing. The Bataclan is, of course, one of the most horrific terrorist attack which has happened in Europe. As I'm sure you and your audience know, it's far worse than we were even told about. People were tortured to death in front of their loved ones and such, and the police didn't really go in until everyone was dead. Essentially, there were literal sacrificial lambs to the altar of diversity and multiculturalism. And the video with Open Gates, it might have warned some of them. It was a warning, mm-hmm. and it was censored by people with political interests. And the whole thing is just so disgusting and horrific that I decided I would start writing music, and I would never let them censor it. If the SJWs came to me to say, you've got to stop these guys from using music, I would say, get fucked.
Right, exactly.
So that's how it started.
I like electronic music. I like sort of mellow electronic music. I like electronic dance music. I always sort of had the idea that electronic music would be the soundtrack of the next European revolution. I've been saying that for years, and people roll their eyes and think, yeah, right, Greg. But it really is ultra European, as far as I'm concerned, the whole feel of it. To me, when I listen to this kind of music, there's something nostalgic about it. And when the vaporwave thing happened, I was really fascinated by that because it's a form of nostalgia. It's a form of nostalgia for a kind of sound that is from the past, but was associated with a vision of the future. And people have used the term retrofuturism. And it's a kind of painful nostalgia because we feel like we've been robbed of the future that was promised us. I think a lot of people do. You know, we were supposed to have flying cars by now rather than flaming cars in the suburbs of Paris, right, or in Sweden. That future has been taken away. And I don't think there's anything wrong with nostalgia. A lot of people on the left poo-poo it, and they say, you're just nostalgic for an idealized past that never existed. And I just think that's a cliche. Of course, these people are all nostalgic for the muddy hillside at Woodstock. So everybody's nostalgic for something, right? And for a lot of people, I think, who are sort of objectively on the right, they're nostalgic for a future that never happened rather than a past that didn't exist. It's more like for a future that never happened. And electronic music is the soundtrack of that future, I think. Were you influenced at all by the sort of vaporwave phenomenon? I know you use some of the graphics.
Oh, for sure. I don't make my own graphics, by the way. I always ask people who are talented in that kind of field to make those for me. You know, talented in graphic design and sort of visual art. I think what I do is more synthwave than vaporwave. It's perhaps a quite a technical difference in it. The vaporwave is more of a sample based
right
genre, and they take samples, like whole sections of tracks from the 80s, and then maybe sort of slow it down. Process it, put it through some effects and add extra beats and sort of general, some of the sort of production that you'd expect from the 21st century. So it's kind of like updating an 80s sound. I mean, I do like vaporwave, but I can't really say that I've made any, whereas synthwave is, you're working with synths, not samples. So you're making something from scratch, I would say. I mean, I don't think any of my tracks that are sample based. They're all, they all come from the synths.
Right. You do use pre-recorded bits of speeches and things like
that. Oh yeah, yeah, those sort of samples. Yeah, yeah, that's true. Was I influenced by vaporwave? Well, of course, yes. I mean, I was very influenced by the video I mentioned, which used a synthwave background. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've always loved synths. Perhaps like you, I don't know for certain, but I've The first music genre that I really got into was electronic music. When I sort of came of age, I sort of became a teenager in the 90s, and I think it's for most people, it's the music that you listen to that sort of age, which becomes what you think of as being like the good music. When your teenage years, and music has a big part in forming your identity to an extent of like who you feel you are. The music you choose is the music which it speaks to you and sort of almost speaks of you. So the bands I got into, one which I feel like they were my music, were the electronic bands of the 90s. This is the because there were, prior to the 80s, I think, apart from the electronic scene in the 80s, of course, but the 80s seemed to be, the charts seemed to be dominated by like rock, like sort of electric guitars and things, and it was a very macho sort of ego, like sort of hyper, well, I would say sort of hyper masculine in a way, but not in a rather performative way. And it was never my, I always found it a bit, I don't know, that was never my kind of thing. So an electronic sound came in, and it was much more kind of what I was into. It seemed to be less sort of ego driven. It seemed to be less sort of more mystical. And it seemed to be speaking about the possibility of an amazing future. And I'm talking about in the 90s here. And alongside that, there was the rise of computer technology and the internet in the 90s, and there's all sorts of promise of this sort of utopian future that seems to be. And also, I got very into this guy Terence McKenna, if you have ever heard of him.
Yeah, I'm familiar with him.
You're familiar. I was a naive teenager, so hearing this guy sort of rambling, using words that I didn't understand and probably still don't, because I think he was actually making up a lot of words. About how amazing things were going to be just around the corner, that the internet was going to be this thing which would form a sort of a global mind, and we would all go and live in sort of cyberspace and hyperspace. And he used this phrase, shed the monkey body. And all this seemed very, shed the monkey body and sort of like evolve into a higher form. And all that seemed to really appeal to me at the time. It's part of the sort of zeitgeist of the sort of alternative. So I was very influenced by bands like Orbital and The Orb and System 7 and Eat Static and Aphex Twin, of course, and Dreadzone, all the sort of big names from the sort of 90s electronic rave scene. Do you know those bands?
Oh yeah. I'm especially familiar with Aphex Twin.
Oh, of course, yeah. Now, he went a bit. The album of his that I really like is that Selective Ambient Works. Some of his other stuff is just too sort of postmodern and dark for me, and I'm not. I've no idea where he's placed politically. I'm not sure if it even matters. I think he's see. Another thing about the 90s, it was almost like politics didn't matter back then. It seemed to be such a sort of freewheeling time. It's like politicians were just boring men in suits, and who cared what they did? The Berlin Wall come down in 89. It seemed like, this whole end of history shtick was generally believed, and especially as I was influenced by this guy Terence McKenna and sort of related authors and speakers. He took the end of history thing to a whole nother level, and said it was, it's not just the end of history as we know it, but this is the end of a cycle of time. And in fact, the end of time itself. And we were going to go into this other dimension in 2012, which all sounds so preposterous now. But to me, as a wide-eyed teenager, not knowing what I was going to do with my life, those ideas seems exciting. But it's one of those things, as the 2012 got closer and closer, and it became much more of a public phenomenon, this idea that 2012 was the end of the world, and that there was even a film called 2012, which was just ridiculous. As I got older, and it became obvious that that wasn't going to happen. Of course, 2012 came and went without a bump. And by that time, I no longer really believed in the whole 2012 phenomenon. I think a lot of people were disappointed. So you were talking about, you asked me about nostalgia, electro music nostalgia. I think that, you know, vaporwave and synthwave, they speak to a time in the 80s when, as you say, there was, and I think this is true of the 90s as well, there was this promise of this better future, which didn't seem to happen. But also in the 80s, it seems like that was the last time that the West really believed in itself, even if it was just believing in rampant capitalism and consumerism and that this was the way forward. I think that by the 90s, there was a certain cynicism which had crept into the West. So a lot of the young were like total escapists, like they didn't, you know. But then I think something happened around the end of the 90s where that sort of utopian zeal something went dark and the music went darker. And by the time the millennium happened, that optimism was gone. And then, of course, by 2001, when September the 11th happened, I think there's such a shockwave and such a reminder that, you know, history hasn't really ended. We thought history had ended because we thought, well, there's peace in Europe now and peace across, you know, the peace with the Russians. It's like that all the big struggles are done. In fact, my generation is called Generation X because X was supposed to mean who knows what they're going to do because all the big struggles are over. This is the first generation without a mission, they used to say, without a struggle, nothing to fight against. Because it's all been done, it's all been taken care of, you know, it's all just going to be in a happy neoliberalism from now on, we'll just be consumers and we're going to get on. And September 11th reminds you that that was not the case at all, and there were people in the world with very, very different ideas. It was, very much a shock to the system across the world. And for me at that time, what happened with me is by the end of the 90s, I think I'd been to uni. I actually did a degree in artificial intelligence because I was very inspired by the whole sort of the computer and internet stuff, which I didn't really have a very good idea about at the beginning of the 90s. By the end of it, I'd done a degree in that. And what I realized was what I was more into was not artificial intelligence. I think still today people have lots of kind of mystical ideas about it, this idea that we're going to create minds which will sort of live in boxes and they're going to be so much better than us and outthink us in every way. And I simply don't think that's what's going to happen. But I was attracted to that mystical vision of artificial intelligence. What I found was that I was actually much more interested in mysticism itself. And I projected those ideas into this field of artificial intelligence, which when I studied it, I actually found was actually quite dry and boring. And I don't think this will ever deliver the things that a lot of people think it will, certainly not in its current form. So for me, in the years from about 2000 to around 2010, I got very, very into meditation and spiritual practices and Taoism. And that became my focus. And I was still writing music during this time, because that was partly why for most of my sort of adult life, I didn't really care about politics at all. You know, I'm not sure if it's right to say I was apolitical, but politics, as I said, in the 90s just seemed to be like the sort of managerial thing. It's just the people that manage the economy, guys, boring guys in suits who, you know, made uninteresting statements. And then in the years between 2000 and 2010, it seemed to be a continuation of that attitude to politics. But then there was this sort of growing unspoken thing about, Islamic extremism and sort of threats to Western civilization and such. And for me at that time, my main focus was meditation and spiritual practice during that time. And I took it very seriously. It wasn't a sort of side hobby. I actually I would practice meditation for an hour every day. I had a personal teacher in my city who I would see regularly. For a time, I even went to live in an ashram for a year and work closely with an enlightened master. You know, that was my 2000s. But the only sort of politics that was interesting was this stuff about 9/11 truth, this idea that, you know, the political class aren't really being honest with us, and maybe there's some other story to 9/11, and because there are still unanswered questions about all that, and I'm sure you don't want to get into it, I'm sure everybody knows, but it seems that you know, whatever happened there, the public was definitely not told the whole truth, and still, and probably never will be. I went to live in that ashram. Eventually, I decided to leave. I came back to the city that I was born in. And I think by this time, you know, a lot of my friends had sort of moved on to different things. And so I sort of needed a new circle of friends. And I found, well, by chance, I think I joined a cycling group because I was a keen cyclist. And the leader of the cyclist group was a staunch left-wing sort of vegan climate change activist. I think by this time, I'm not quite sure. I think I was already a bit skeptical about climate change. And but he invited me to invited like everybody in the cycling group, in fact, to this what was supposed to be a social center, which had been set up in my city, which was a squat. I remember the Occupy movement was going around this. This was shortly, I think, after the 2008 financial crash, which is another sort of key marker, I think, in my sort of political journey. Because that, you know, after only being really interested in this sort of 9/11 stuff and not believing the policy, then suddenly the financial crash happened, and it seemed well, the banking system is another kind of lie which is going on, and nobody really knows about and understands fractional reserve banking, and it's not talked about in the mainstream, but it seems to be just a massive scam. And so I guess I was sort of political. I was kind of a political dissident at this time. But I just assumed that, you know, I thought political dissidents lived on the left. So I was invited to this social center squat, which was, well, the idea was it was going to be off grid. It was going to have solar panels, and they were going to grow their own food and filter their own water. And having been seen on the internet, this sort of the 9/11 and the banking crisis, and this, a lot of that feeds into a sort of, there's a potential of a collapse here, you know, the kind of libertarian sort of don't trust the government sort of stuff. I was attracted to that. I was interested in learning skills to do with, you know, how to survive outside of society. What would we do if the lights go off? That kind of thing. And through this, you know, I became a regular at this place, like turning up to do sort of volunteer work and things. I got to know a lot of the left wingers there, and this is around 2009 to around perhaps 2011. It's all getting a bit vague. So I got to know sort of leftists very really close up, and by this point I was already skeptical about climate change. I was already skeptical about feminism, and I ended up clashing with them over some of these this on social media. You know, my disagreements with them essentially politicized me further, and I became more and more what I now understand to be right wing. So disagreeing with them over things like whether capitalism was bad or not, maybe more libertarian. Disagreeing with them over feminism made me look into more of the sort of the manosphere and sort of men's rights kind of stuff. The more I talked to them, the more I realized I actually disagreed. And some of these, and this, I talked to Millennial Words about this, that they, as we all know, the left don't take disagreement very well at all. And they ended up getting extremely hostile to me. I became very disillusioned with them. I think that there's more I could speak about with how this this social center was run. Well, one of the things about this social center was it was supposed to be non-hierarchical, and that anybody could turn up and pitch in and do their thing. And it was, you know, this idea that, you know, it's very anarchistic, right? You know, in theory, you know, it's a lovely idea. There's, you know, no masters, no one's going to tell you what to do. But in reality, what was going on is that there was a small clique of people, and if you wanted to do anything there, you basically had to okay it with them. If you hadn't okayed it with them, then it couldn't happen. Whereas these the clique, they could do whatever they wanted, and nobody could stop them. So what I saw happening, you know, with my own eyes was that non-hierarchy is a bit of a joke. And what ends up happening is that you end up with an unaccountable group who nobody else can stop. So these guys did whatever they wanted. Nobody could stop them, but they would stop other people from doing things. And yet, if something went right, they would take credit for it. Oh, great. Oh, it's all working so well. If something went wrong, then it was everybody else's fault. Oh, no one's in charge here. You know, it's non-hierarchical. So you end up with the worst of both worlds, that you have an unaccountable hierarchy who never take responsibility for when things go wrong. And things did go very badly wrong there.
Well, this is sort of a microcosm of liberalism in a way, because we have a society basically ruled by invisible, unaccountable elites.
That's right. That's right. This is something I think Adam Curtis talks about in the film The Trap, that liberalism or neoliberalism is a kind of abdication of responsibility and power. The politicians are just managers. You know, they're not actually going to wield power and use it against, you know, for anything, allegedly. But what you end up with is an unaccountable money elite that nobody has control of.
Exactly. That's a very much a Carl Schmittian kind of perspective as well. I mean, Schmitt basically says that liberalism is an attempt to evade the responsibility of sovereignty, of somebody having ultimate decision-making power and therefore also being accountable for the consequences of those decisions. They think that's terrifying thought, that somebody should have all that power. But of course, what that means is that they don't create a system where there is real power and real accountability for power, but power still exists. And therefore, it sort of roams around outside any regular state channels, and ultimately it reposes with the people who have money.
Right. Yeah. This experience I had with this left-wing collective was really educational for me, because I saw that happen, you know, in real time with my own eyes. And it's perhaps if I'd just heard someone talk about, make a critique of non-hierarchy or liberalism, it would have just sort of gone in one ear and out the other, and it's like, oh, I don't know. But when having actually experienced that, I mean, I think I am kind of someone that experiences educate me much better than ideas do, I think. That experience is something which I still think about, and it was very very eye opening. And I should probably add, the reason I left the ashram that I was in, because that ashram was very hierarchical, in that there was the master at the top, there was the people that ran the community for him, and then the people that had important jobs in the community, and then sort of everyone else who just had cleaning jobs and things. And I guess I was somewhere within, you know, having at some point unwittingly absorbed left-wing ideas that hierarchies are bad, I always felt a little bit like, oh, you know, oh, I don't like the hierarchy here, but hey, this is how we do, this is how it's a, yeah, there's an attitude, because the place was run on the notion you're here to let go of your ego, right? You're here to practice your meditation and you should get to know yourself much better, or get to know your faults better, and that means it's at times being put in a situation which might be uncomfortable. This was done in that place through the hierarchies, as I mentioned. And I got on fairly well. I guess I was in the tier of people that had important jobs. My job actually was that I was a essentially a scribe. The community was in Germany, you see, so most people, and I had people from all around the world, well, all around Europe more specifically. Not everybody could speak, had English as their first language, but the master, the main guy, the main teacher, he was English. And he would, as well as doing these long meditation sessions, he would do things like question and answer sessions and give talks, which would be recorded and then would be transcribed, and the best ones were turned into books. And my job was to be the transcriber, and editor. Because I was English for one thing. I mean, there were other English people there, but I was, so I it turned out that I had quite a good knack for it. I've done like a fair bit of writing. I have 2 degrees, and I was always quite good at sort of English literature and things. At the time that I went there to that community, there was someone else doing the transcribing who was supposed to be a writer, but she was making an absolute mess of his talk, totally butchering his talks. And there was a huge backlog of unfinished talks which hadn't been transcribed. And I turned up there, and I kind of got it right straight away. I transcribed and edited a talk, handed it in, and he didn't even need to make any corrections to it. So then I was put in charge of that department. Unfortunately, the person who'd been doing that before was a friend of mine, but she actually really resented me for that. And then she started finding ways to sort of pick at me. Oh, sorry, wait. I'm trying to tell you a story here. But the reason I left the ashram was because one of the people in the tier above me lied about me to the guy in charge. So and it was over, actually something pretty small, to be fair. I'd taken a day off when she thought I shouldn't have done, and the thing is, it was actually up to her whether I got the day off or not, and she actually okayed it. But then she told the guy in charge that I'd just been making excuses and things. So the truth was, I had a cold or something. I just needed a day to recover. And then I got a bollocking for that, and it kind of made me think this place is corrupt, and it's because of the hierarchy. The hierarchy is corrupt. And I hate hierarchies, and I decided the whole place wasn't worth me staying in. So I left because of that, which in reflection, was a small thing. And then I got involved with this non-hierarchical collective in my home city when I came back. And I saw how awful non-hierarchy is. I mean, and it was much more educational because I realized that hierarchies are inevitable and they're actually part of nature. You're always going to get a hierarchy, no matter what. Even if the people are saying it's non-hierarchical, you'll still get a hierarchy because people have different skills. So, some people are just better at certain skills than others, and if those are important skills, those people will end up going up the hierarchy, just as I did in the ashram, where I was good at transcribing and editing, so I kind of went up the hierarchy a little bit.
Right.
So that formed a big part of my thinking from then on, and still does, that hierarchies are natural and not bad at all. But there is still this, with the caveat that yes, hierarchies can become corrupt. I think that is the problem with hierarchies, is that they can be corrupted by a dishonest agent at some point in the chain of command.
Right. And that's why you need accountability and oversight. People's decisions need to be checkable and reviewable by higher ups and so forth. And you need an ethos in any hierarchy where the people on top, they have to cultivate a willingness of the people below them to speak frankly to them and bring them bad news. Because
Absolutely,
the
absolutely.
greatest form of brittleness in any kind of hierarchy is when you get somebody at the top who becomes basically isolated from the world because he's surrounded by yes men and people who just try and feed his ego and reinforce his prejudices.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness, is that ever true? That's just I've had an experience with that recently with actually an activist group I was involved with where exactly that happened. Much more recently, but yeah, that hierarchies are inevitable and they can go wrong, but that doesn't mean that hierarchy is bad. And the thing is, you're going to end up with a hierarchy no matter what.
Right.
Now, I'm just well aware that you asked me a particular question and I've gone far, far away on a tangent.
Well, I kind of wanted to get a sense of your intellectual's journey, and that's what you've been telling us. So,
All right.
yeah, just keep going. So, what was the next step that took you into the dissident right, I guess?
Basically, my bad experience with these leftists kind of catapulted me towards the right when I hadn't really been explicitly political before. And so I did my time in the sort of libertarian sphere, and I was quite involved with sort of men's rights discussions, you know, the whole sort of manosphere thing. I'm not sure if I was ever really an MRA specifically, but I certainly I took on board a lot of their ideas. I got very into evolutionary psychology as opposed to the sort of social constructivism, which had kind of formed the background of much of my education. Because I did A-levels and things like psychology and English, which obviously that they may not mean to, or maybe they do mean to. You end up absorbing this sort of social constructivist stuff without properly challenging it. It was interesting. Because when I did the degree in artificial intelligence, that they were looking at psychology from a much more sort of mechanistic biological point of view, and that at that time didn't quite sit well with me. I mean, obviously, I just wrote the essays as I was told, you know, as it was taught. But I do remember my default position was towards the social constructivism and the blank slate kind of thing, which I now realize is false. That there are ways in which we're wired to perceive and see things. I think that's correct. Of course, there are other ways. There are some things which are socially constructed, of course. But so much of, I mean, when I started reading evolutionary psychology, that was another sort of game changer. And then, of course, so the reality of Islamic terrorism, you know, that this is, I think that's one of the things which sort of got me out of the libertarian mindset, when you the sort of libertarian individualist thing, when you realize that collectives can actually just crush a society which is based on individualism. I think that's the sort of phase I was at in 2015, when, as I spoke about, the Bataclan attack happened and this video went viral. And that's when I really started writing music as Zurius. And I mean, since 2015, I think I've encountered more right-wing ideas. I mean, moving away from the sort of libertarian thing. I think one of the biggest influences on me now is radical traditionalism, and also the writings of the French New Right, like particularly Guillaume Fay, and this notion of archaeofuturism, which, as you said earlier on, is a kind of a combination of radical traditionalist ideas from the past with a forward-looking technological vision. So this is, I think, finally I've got to answer your question about a combination of past and future to create a new vision for what could be. See, the sort of nostalgia you speak about, nostalgia, I think it's a very powerful and beautiful emotion, actually. But I'm not just trying to make people lament a past that possibly never was or dream for a future which cannot be. I'm not really trying to do. I mean, I'll just come out and say it. I think one of the reasons nostalgia is such a powerful emotion is because what we really long for is reunion with the divine. That's what, right? That's what I really think. So nostalgia will always be extremely popular. There'll always be a longing for this thing which we don't quite have access to, or we seemingly don't have access to, and yet is always there as a force creating all of life, as I see it. So that's the true nostalgia. So nostalgia is a very powerful emotion. I'm not just trying to get people to be nostalgic about the 80s. I don't think the 80s were actually that good. I think perhaps the true loss is the loss of vision of a more beautiful future. But the truth is, we can have that back. We just have to look at things differently. So a beautiful future is still there, and it will always be there for us. We just have to move that direction, as I see it. So I'm very against blackpilling people, because I think a blackpill is a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. Whatever you focus on becomes your reality. Whatever you focus on grows. So if you focus on pessimism and blackpilling, well, that will be what your mind defaults to, and it's a terrible trap to get into. So I am kind of more into sort of the opposite of sort of white pilling people, saying, you know, the beautiful future is there for us if we work towards it. And that's what I'm trying to get at with my music. That's much more my kind of wavelength. Yeah, yes, we know that society has fallen out of sync with natural order in a sense that anything is spiritual. But that's only society that's fallen out of sync. And it's only a way of thinking which is out of sync. And when you realize that, well, then you can think differently.
Yeah, I think that's really very beautifully said. What is the etymology of your name, Zurius? How did you arrive at that?
Oh, right. Well, that is not a really great story, to be honest. I think at some point during my political journey, I was a Reddit user. I think it was involved the libertarian manosphere sort of thing. I was a Reddit user, and I had to write my account got banned again. I had to make a new account, and I was pissed off, and I used the word furious, but I mistyped it, and it came down Zurius. And when I saw it on the screen, I thought, oh, I kind of like that. I'll keep it. So I used it as a Reddit name for a while, not just Zurius back then, but Zurius with some other characters. And then when I decided to start writing music for the Dissident Right, I used that name again. So, I mean, I do like sort of serendipity and synchronicity and this kind of thing. I think the creative process is something which always this element of chance and randomness. And also, I mean, at some point I've read and sort of digested Jung and his notions of synchronicity. So I like synchronous, creative, sort of spontaneous things like that. So the name came first as a kind of an act of chance. I mean, I'm also I use the I Ching. I've ever since for years I've used it. So I'm quite into this idea of chance events sometimes being the things which point the way forward. Sometimes, because that there's the way I see things, there is a greater mind at work in creation. It's not just us. It's that there's something else going on too, and we're part of that thing. So that's where Zurius came from, and then I sort of made a kind of a justification for it later. Was the X is one of these symbols which means the mystery. In fact, the community, the ashram I worked with, was used the symbol X a lot to symbolize the mystery and the union with the mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of the name, like Furious, but with the F removed, it's kind of like I'm saying I'm an angry mystic. That's kind of what I'm saying. I'm a mystic and I'm angry at the state of the world, because I think it's right to be angry at the state of the world, because it is out of sync with natural order and what could be. And it's kind of our role to steer it back to where it ought to be. And this is, and I'd thought that actually before I'd encountered the Dissident Right. I think that was my sort of my secret faith, I suppose, although I didn't get it from anywhere else. That when I first got into spiritual practices, for example, meditation and Qigong and these kinds of, the energy work and things, I to begin with, I was very much a kind of evangelical. To an extent, I mean, I never went on the streets handing out leaflets or anything, but I thought if everybody does these things, the whole world will just be better. And I tried, in the early days, I tried to get my friends, my circle of friends at the time, all to get into meditation, but it just didn't stick. They weren't interested. The way I see now is that, the meditation is not perhaps for everybody. It is difficult, especially at the start, to learn, and so it's more like for a select few that actually want it and are prepared to go through some of the sort of grueling early stages. To start with, it's hard work. So I guess that's another way in which I've radical traditionalism comes in again, because there will be some people who are more attuned to spiritual matters than others, what you might call a priest class or something, and so other people who have just got no interest in that at all, and that's actually okay. It's not like not everybody has to do the same thing. People can have different roles and still contribute.
Tell us a bit about the spiritual writers and I guess more broadly, traditionalist or religious writers or political writers that you recommend that have influenced you and that you would recommend other people reading?
Well, obviously, Julius Evola, although I do appreciate some of the way he writes is not all that accessible. But if you wanted a more accessible introduction, I think Morgoth did a great appraisal of Revolt Against the Modern World. And as well as that, Morgoth the YouTuber, of course, a Philosophy Cat has a series on that book as well. There is a fantastic Bowden speech on Julius Evola, the most right-wing thinker, which I go back to all the time and listen to. You know, I've listened to it many times, and each time I hear a bit which I didn't hear before. He's such an incredible speaker. And, you know, the traditionalist school, I believe, was started by René Guénon, and he wrote a book called Crisis of the Modern World. He essentially, bit by bit, predicts that the direction of modernity is going to lead us to a very bad place. And, to a crisis. His solution would be that, apparently he was a Taoist. As, you know, I was a Taoist. He thought that if people within the Catholic Church would start doing Taoist practices, which is to say meditation and Qigong and these kinds of things, that would reconnect them with a experiential sense of the divine, and then there could be a major course correction. And I think he's probably still right, but I'm just not sure if the Catholic Church wants to do that. But essentially what he's saying is that, you know, the church is still there, the hierarchy is there, but it's kind of been hollowed out from the inside, and in that the people running it are not, they don't have a proper an experiential sense of God, which they can't communicate to other people. As I see things, all of that would have been done through the ceremonies and services, that people would have gone to church, and it would have created the possibility for mystical experiences to happen for them. And I think that's much more likely to happen when they were giving the services in Latin and just speaking and singing in this these sort of repetitive, sort of magical tones. And I'm told that Latin masses are still very much like that. I unfortunately wasn't raised Catholic, so I can't speak from that as my own experience. I was raised in the Church of England, which is a rather sterile form of Christianity and rather boring, unfortunately. Although there's still some beautiful architecture. Mm-hmm. I don't want to break. I mean, actually, I say I don't want to break the church. Then I just remember the state of it.
Right.
And it makes me want to break the church. But you know, the potential is there for reformation. I actually do think that. I think that there could be a spiritual revival in the West, and I think it would be extremely healthy. Or maybe people should form new churches. But I think the fact that the divine has been put as a sort of sideshow to our society, which is based around money, and it's like, oh, well, if you want to do, you know, God stuff, then that's, it can be a hobby, rather than, as it would have been for most of civilization, that the temple or the church would have been the tallest and most central building in any community. It would have been a sign that this was a point of civilization and a place of congregation for people, is what the temple and the church would have been. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, we have skyscrapers. We have temples of mammon, temples to money and business and all that. I mean, you know, I did my time in the libertarian space, not against business, but that should not be the central axis of a civilization. It should be the sense that our lives are meaningful beyond what we can see and know. We're part of something greater, and it's and beautiful and beyond imagination.
Right.
And that has a wonderful effect in tying people together.
So who are your favorite composers? And I'm not just talking about classical music, but just music in general. Who are the people that you most enjoy listening to?
Well, I have, I guess, quite a range of tastes. I mean, I do actually enjoy European, like, high classical music. And I do listen to that. I mean, Rachmaninoff is one of my favorites. Wagner, Elgar, Beethoven, Tchaikovsky, all these absolute geniuses. But the way I see it, those guys, start, of course, Vaughan Williams, another one of my favorites. Their music is so superb. It's almost like going to a banquet, and maybe you don't want to have a banquet every day. So maybe sometimes you just want something that's a bit less high powered and but still enjoyable. So I think there will be a place for, what we call pop music, although not the current chart music. That's awful. The sort of popular music I like is obviously synthwave. So as well as listening to a lot of classical music, I listen to synthwave music, which I do see as you said, as being part of the European tradition. I see synths as being the continuation of the long line of European innovation in musical instrument building. Well, it's not it's not controversial in these circles to say that Europeans are the main innovators. Now, one of our great innovations is the invention of musical instruments that I don't think any other people would have made. If you look at the and the thing is, one of the problems for us is that we take our culture for granted. Perhaps we don't. Perhaps your audience doesn't. But certainly, the current state of the West just takes our incredibly rich inheritance for granted, and we take the musical instruments that we our ancestors invented for granted. But each one was an amazing step in its own right. If you think about something like a trumpet. We might not. You just said, "Well, trumpets have existed my whole life. I think there's nothing big to." Well, it took a long. There's a long evolution to create something like a trumpet, and it would require a long, continuous civilization to be able to hone metal to that level of skill, to understand how to bend the tubes in such a way to create the tones that you want to make. That whole sort of piston thing with the fingers is always a fascinating. It's a pretty advanced instrument, is a trumpet, even though we just take it for granted. The same with something like a violin, or just take your pick of any instrument out of the classical European orchestra. We made those things. They are the result of our civilization. And the way I see synths is synthesizers that they're part of that continuation. We invented keyboard instruments. The first ones would have been organs, which is an organ is essentially a way of playing a flute but using a keyboard to do it. So you can play multiple notes at once, so polyphony as it's called. And the keyboard instrument then progressed through into things like harpsichords and then of course pianos. The synth is the inheritor of much of that. And then with synth, of course, the sounds are not made through like a human blowing on something or drawing a bow across a string or plucking it. They're made by electronic oscillators, and but the invention of the discovery of electricity and circuitry, all of this is European stuff. A synth, as I say, is a continuation of European. So only we could have made that. Synthwave is great. It's exists within all the scales and tones that have been figured out from thousands of years ago. Understanding that relationship between frequencies, like frequencies of vibration and pitch, that's like the beginning of a seed of an idea which has grown into all of European instrumentation and music. And of course, the synth is wouldn't exist without that. So I don't think you asked me, but I've just got onto a bit of a spiel about why I think that synths are. And synthwave music are part of the canon of European music.
For me, I think of synthesizers in sort of Spenglerian terms, I guess. Spengler talks about the Faustian as this longing for the infinite. And when I think of pure electronic sounds, and I don't mean just electronic sounds that imitate other instruments, but things that could only be made with an electronic synthesizer, I hear the sound of infinite spaces. And it draws something out in me. It's a powerful experience.
I agree. It's like the music of the spheres.
Exactly. Exactly.
I think when people thousands of years ago first heard tone, I think the first tones they would have heard would have been from the voice. And from that, people would have discovered harmony by singing together. And then people would have discovered that by striking or bowing against certain objects, you can produce similar tones. Sometimes you can make a tone by banging a rock against something like a stalactite, if it's, you know, anything that can vibrate. I have a theory that, I was raised playing the violin. I spent much of my youth playing in orchestras. I have a theory that the violin was originally a weapon, believe it or not.
Well, I think of the bow, right?
Exactly.
The bow and the harp, they're both created by a string in tension with wood, sometimes
right.
Metal, tortoiseshell, whatever. Apollo was associated with the lyre and the bow.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Right. Well, obviously, I'm not the only one that's made that connection. I thought I discovered it on my own. But yes, I think the violin was originally a bow and arrow, and you can look back to some of the older instruments that a bow and arrow, but it's probably two bows that they drew one bow across the other. Mm-hmm. Eventually, they started adding extra strings, and that also creates the harp. Then from the harp, you get the harpsichord. And that's why, of course, pianos are, you know, the classical piano, the concert piano, is in the shape of a harp, because it's basically a harp which has been put on its side.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how you get the harpsichord, and then the piano is, instead of plucking those strings, it's striking it with little hammers.
Mm-hmm.
I think even from times past when people heard tones, it has this transporting effect.
Well, they call the bow on a violin a bow, which is, of course, a bow and arrow. It's the same principle, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Things, even though the bow is not bow-shaped, this is what first got me thinking, what's going on there? Why do they call it a bow when the thing's straight? It's straight and it's got like horsehairs across it. Why is this called a bow? And then thinking more about, well, originally they wouldn't have been straight. And you can see in sort of medieval paintings of violin type instruments, the bows really are bow shaped, and they do look like a bow and arrow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bow and arrow type bow. And that's what got me thinking about that. That was my thesis, which I came up with. Well, I call it a thesis, just an idea that I came up with a few years ago, but obviously I'm not the only one that's realized that.
Well, this is absolutely fascinating. Let's wrap up. Can you tell people how they can follow you on BitChute, on Twitter? Do you have a website? Things like that.
I don't actually have a website. I use Twitter a lot, and I post music to BitChute now because YouTube have censored me. By the way, they called my instrumental music hate speech. Shut down my entire channel. Before they did that, they put all these legal complaints against each of my videos. They banned it in most European countries and Israel, but not in America. So for a while, I could upload something to YouTube. It would get, within minutes, it would get this legal complaint email, and then I couldn't see it. And people in my country in Europe couldn't see it, and presumably Israel too couldn't see it. But Americans could. So for a while, and probably Canadians too, for a while it was like I was in this halfway position where I still sort of had an audience, but not, I couldn't see it myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think, well, it was some point last year they decided just to get rid of me completely and just say, yeah, we're banning the whole thing for hate speech. I appealed when they were putting these legal complaints. First, they did it on one of my pieces of music. I did a track called The Hero with a Thousand Faces, which wasn't even political. That was the first one they censored. They made the legal complaint, and I think they put it in limited state. No. And of course I appealed it, and they just ignored the appeal. And then they did it with a whole load more of my tracks. And then they did it over all of them. I think it was in August. They just decided to do everything I've ever uploaded, including things which I'd never made public, including things which nobody had ever seen. So how could they be making a legal complaint? This is how I realized that the thing was coming from within YouTube itself.
Right.
This wasn't some outside, somebody, in Israel or some other country deciding to make a legal complaint. This was coming from within YouTube because they were doing it to things which I'd never made public.
Right. Exactly. I had experiences like this. Basically, everybody who uses a platform like Facebook, you think you're having a conversation with your friends. There's always somebody listening. There's always somebody monitoring you. And it's a situation analogous to if you are making a phone call and there's some operator who's listening to your call and decides to cut you off because they don't like what you're saying. We would never put up with that. But we put up with that with social media. And really, it's outrageous. It should
outrageous.
Not be the case that there are people basically monitoring our conversations constantly.
And we have no idea who they are, what their political beliefs are. Maybe they just hate us. Maybe they're mentally ill.
A lot of them are mentally ill. When they talk about themselves, they talk about their mental illnesses. I'm not hypothesizing. I'm just taking what these people say at face value. A lot of the SJW types are messed up people on antidepressants and harder stuff. So yeah, it's an outrageous situation. There were people trolling through your unpublished music, looking at it, figuring out an angle to censor it.
Yeah, the thing is that the legal complaint thing, I actually, when they did my whole channel with this legal complaint, I took one of their emails and I actually went to see my member of parliament and showed it to her and said, you know, YouTube, somebody at YouTube is trying to destroy my music career. And I showed her the email that they sent, and it was on one of my non-political tracks. So, you know, you struggle. The track was called May Angels Smile Upon You. That's the one I showed my MP. You know, something you think anyone would find it difficult to take umbrage with. And she just looked at it straight away and said, well, this isn't legal. But she also said, well, there's nothing I can really do because this is YouTube. And YouTube is kind of a law. And she didn't use those words. But YouTube is basically making up laws of its own. It's such a big corporation that they almost, you could see it as a country, you know, it's a country in cyberspace, which is making up its own laws.
It's even worse than that because they engage in active campaigns to influence the actual politics of other countries. Facebook does it, Google does it, YouTube does it. These are unaccountable private entities that are engaged in election tampering in every country on the earth that has elections.
Yeah.
It's utterly intolerable. And you'd think that one day one of these countries is going to get so angry that they send commandos to stop this. That's what a serious country would do, but they all are quaking in terror at these colossal corporations that can interfere in the entire life of the planet. I was basically wiped off of Amazon.com during last year. They started about exactly a year ago by taking down 17 of my titles. Then months later, they completely axed all of my remaining Kindle books and said they were offensive. And I wrote back and I said, well, and this was also done to me by another platform called academia.edu. They canceled my account and I went through this process and asked why did they do it. And well, you uploaded something offensive. And I said to them, I said, well, look, if I uploaded something offensive, why don't you tell me what it was and I can take it down? To completely cancel my account does not say that you are reacting to something that I wrote that was offensive. You're reacting to me. You're suppressing me as a person. And Amazon did the same thing. And finally, Amazon basically stopped selling all of our books. Most of them, they even took down the product pages. So it's as if the book never existed.
Christ.
But there were a lot of books that weren't even really political. Collections of poetry. My From Plato to Postmodernism book. Things like that. And it became very, very clear to me that what is going on here is that this corporation, one of the biggest corporations on the planet, was not simply censoring things that I said because they could be much more surgical about it if they wanted to do that. They were attacking me as an individual economically. One of the biggest corporations in the world, run by one of the richest men in the world, is waging economic warfare targeted at me because of my political views. It's an intolerable situation that we're living under. This is the worst sort of corporate tyranny, and leftists love it because they're in charge of it.
It's extremely disturbing. It reminds me of the sort of the utopian idea of the internet from the 90s. And one of the books I read back then, which sort of influenced me at the time, was called The Awakening Earth by Stephen Russell. Just I can still remember the title of the book and the author. And his hypothesis was that humanity, you know, similar to Terence McKenna, was going to a new level of evolution with the internet. And this was building on the Gaia hypothesis, this idea that the Earth is alive. He was building on that and saying the internet, this interconnectivity of minds, was going to build a new, well, a mind of the Earth. It was like a nervous system for the Earth. And that we were going to see the emergence of this new form of consciousness, this new mind of the Earth, which would be our kind of representation of our collective consciousness, our collective understanding. And it sounds wonderful. It sounds like, yeah, we're going to this new level of evolution. And I think if you take that at face value and say, well, that is what's happened, what we've discovered in seeing the internet emerge as it has is that we're not very well. That as a species, no one really predicted in the 90s the massive rise of internet porn, for example,
right?
Or the awful narcissism of social media. And I think you could broadly say porn is an expression of the unspoken parts of the male mind, perhaps, and social media, this narcissism, is like the dark side of femininity. It's to an extent, because it used to be that men were the biggest user of the internet, and the biggest thing they did was porn, and then social media came up and overtook it, and that was largely women using it. And we see that social media has become this sort of like, look at me, get likes, this terrible narcissism, this incredible investment in really superficial features. It's like this sort of hyper, some people call it hyper realism, but I think it's extreme hyper unrealism. It reminds me of that, in the Hindu tradition, I think they talk about Maya, the world of illusion and mind. And, yes, to pull into radical traditions again, you could say that is a kind of an expression of the Kali Yuga. I'm not a big fan of this Kali Yuga talk, but I think there's sometimes it's useful as an idea that part of the Kali Yuga is that Maya is dominant, the illusion is dominant, whereas the reality of things is distant. So we live in this very superficial social media driven age, and to make matters worse with the censorship, if the internet is a global mind, then what the censorship is lobotomizing that mind.
Exactly. Well, remember the Tay AI that was started up and was allowed to interact with social media and rapidly became a racist, an open racist. And so the reaction was, well, we need to lobotomize the AI. We need to lobotomize it because obviously it's not thinking the proper thoughts. It's like, well, why don't we take these machines seriously? If this is what machines are arriving at, maybe they're smarter than us, because they don't have a conscience and they don't have ideologies. They don't have these inhibitions. They just interact with the world and draw conclusions. And lo and behold, well, we have to lobotomize the artificial intelligence to make it a good citizen of the world that these woke, politically correct corporations are trying to create.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, you'd think people would be wiser than that, because one thing we learned from Freud, although I'm sure everyone has their criticism of Freud, is that to repress ideas means that they will just be expressed in a more unhealthy way, right, in a more uncontrolled way. So it'd be far better just to allow for some... allow for what needs to be said to be said. I think so much of what's occurred with the dissident writers, the things that people aren't allowed to say in public life have come out on the internet because there was this avenue for free speech for a while, this avenue for free speech. And I think that's perhaps most directly represented in Pol itself, which was Pol was, you know, the meaning of it is politically incorrect. So that's where a lot of people went to say things which are not allowed within the repressive structures of political correctness. Okay, I'm not saying everything said on Pol is good or whatever.
It's the global id, basically.
That's kind of, yeah.
Oh, well, it's what's being repressed.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the id is sort of seen as this like sort of degenerate. Well, perhaps that's the wrong word. But you can say of the id, it's always honest. At least it's always honest.
This has been a wonderful conversation, and I say this to everybody, but I really, really mean it, and I really mean it in this case. We should do another conversation soon. I've really enjoyed this.
Great. Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on.